This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I got a call in December of 2008 from my secretary saying there's a man called Mr. Barata who would like to talk to you. And I said, who is he? What does he want to talk about? She said, I don't know. It's something to do with a Biennale. And I said, okay. So, give him my cell phone number. So 5 minutes later, I get a call and says, this is Paolo Barata. I am president of the Biennale, and I have a problem, and perhaps you can help me. And I said, hello, Mr. Barata. Congratulations, because I knew that he had just been appointed. What is your problem, and maybe I can help? And he said, well, I was just appointed president, and my predecessor forgot to appoint a director of the Architecture Biennale. Now, for those of you that follow Biennales, there's a lot behind this, because his predecessor was a disaster. And I think that's universally understood. His executive director, who was supposed to be doing it day to day, was a disaster. The whole place was on the verge of falling apart. And so Paolo Barata, who had been president before, came in and saved the day. And Paolo Barata, by the way, turns out to be one of the most incredible people alive today, really incredible leader. We should have him leading anything, anything whatsoever. So he said, well, so I don't have a curator, and this exhibition opens about 8 months from now. And I said, well, Mr. Barata, that's very interesting, because I did the Dutch Pavilion 3 times, and I always thought that if you were going to do a Biennale, what you really need to concentrate on is that it's a spectacle. The great thing about the Biennale is that whatever you think about them in moral or ethical terms, or even in terms of the truths of architecture, they are the one place where everyone in the world comes together to look at and think about what architecture is today. And it's even more true for art. And if they get criticized, you can't ever do them right, but it is the place where it all comes together. And what it needs and what it often lacks is a spectacle to ground it. Some sense that people really are here for this kind of explosion of colors and forms and textures that together offer a critical alternative to the banality of everything we already know. And I went on like this for a few more minutes, and there was a brief silence, and then Mr. Barata said, I think you have solved my problem. And I said, well, hold on a second, I have a day job, and I'm not sure I can do this. And he said, well, you have to come, you know, you have to do this. So I said, if I'm going on too long, stop me.
No.
I said, well, as it happens, I'm taking my first vacation in 3 years. And we are going to Amalfi, because we found out it's really cheap to go to Amalfi in Christmas time. And he said, good, I will come see you there. I said, okay. So we go to Amalfi, and we install ourselves there. And the next day, a chauffeur Mercedes shows up, and Barata gets out. And we have this wonderful lunch together. And he, at the end of the lunch, he says, at least go look at the space. So I say, okay, why not? So we get in the car, there goes our vacation, and we drive from Amalfi to Venice, which is, whatever that is, 800 kilometers, and we park at the Piazzale di Roma and put our bags down at the hotel and walk over to the Arsenale, and one of the absolutely stellar staff, by the way, a very short answer to how you do a Biennale, is you have the most incredible staff that I've ever seen assembled in one place. And that's the Biennale staff. They are absolutely unbelievable. And one of them was this guy called Max Masmiano. And so Max meets us there on a very cold day, right the day before Christmas, and walks up to the Arsenale, the Corderia, the rope-making factory, and opens up the door. And I had been there many times to see the Art and Architecture Biennale, but I had never seen it empty. So he opens up these huge wooden doors, and there is half a mile of space, medieval, high-vaulted, brick-columned space, completely empty. And Max just goes, like that. And Peter, my partner, looks at me, looks at the space, looks at me and goes, well, there goes 2008. What are we doing in 2009? Because you can't turn down the opportunity to fill that space. So to get a little bit more serious, the problem for me and what I meant by spectacle was that I have done over 100 exhibitions on architecture, and I'm not sure that any of them are any good. And that's because it is virtually impossible to make an exhibition of architecture. And I think we can maybe have some interesting discussions about the terms of, because monstrare means not just to show, but to reveal, make public. And to unfold, of course, is also has wonderful overtones. But in the West and in a traditional art museum, you usually have to put something on a pedestal or in a frame. And the problem is that architecture usually resides in buildings, and buildings don't usually fit inside other buildings. So what you wind up doing is having scale models or drawings of buildings that don't have any of the spatial sense of those buildings, drawings that only nerds like us understand, color photographs that are these sappy Disneyland versions of what maybe the buildings look like at sunset, and no sense of architecture. So I had already been experimenting at SF MoMA with ways in which you could show architecture itself, which is to say, to get at the essential qualities of architecture. And for the Biennale, I made what I thought was a very simple argument, which was a disaster because I still think I'm communicating clearly, but obviously I failed utterly because I don't think anyone really understood it. But it was a simple argument that the way you show architecture perhaps is not to show buildings, because architecture is not buildings. We think they're the same thing, but they are most definitely not. Buildings are buildings. They are objects with spaces, and building is a verb, to build something. Architecture is everything that is about buildings. It's how we show buildings, how we draw buildings, how we design buildings, how we talk about buildings, how buildings appear to us. It's everything about buildings. Buildings are the most complete ways in which architecture can appear, but these days especially, buildings are so much defined by issues outside of the discipline of architecture that they more often than not become the tomb of architecture. Buildings are defined by codes, life safety codes, building codes, financial codes, codes of behavior, computer codes, standardized, very little you can do. Not only that, but even in a more general sense, if you were to bring someone in here who is not an architecture person and try to show them where the architecture is here, you would have to do a lot of dancing around to talk about the column that maybe represents structure and skylights and try to talk about spatial proportions, and you eyes would glaze over almost immediately to, again, anyone who's not an architecture nerd. So instead, where do you find architecture? Well, you find it in intentions, in dreams. You find it quite often in places where architecture is more fully realized, like movies and television. You find it in utopian visions. You find it also in interiors that are fully designed, which are more powerful as scene-setting environments than buildings are. Mm-hmm. You find it outside of buildings in landscapes, which equally have a greater power to control an environment. You find it all around buildings and beyond buildings. Mm-hmm. So I said, let us look beyond buildings to find architecture and to show it.
How much of this did you communicate to the architects who were exhibiting? I mean, was it more a question of just picking people you thought could achieve this?
Well, the way I picked then the architects was two different ways. For the what was then called the Italian Pavilion, which is about 20,000 square feet of white box space in the Giardini, in the gardens, I made a survey of what I called experimental architecture. And this is back to the question of the books that I've done, etc. I have been interested for a while in what I call experimental architecture. There's some experimental architects here today, which I think is a mode of making architecture that appeared starting in the 1970s when people realized that utopia, the traditional escape valve for architects who did not want to be just part of a service profession, was precluded, as Tafuri would put it. And that instead one had to think of architecture as a way of experimenting on and in the world, real world. And it started at places like the Institute for Architecture and Urban Studies right around the corner from here, and at the AEA in London. And by now there's three or four generations of architects doing that. So I basically first put my students to work and explained what I meant by experimental architecture and said, okay, go. And they turned on their computers and came back the next morning with hundreds of sites. And then I put a former colleague of mine at the NEI, Emiliano Gandolfi, to work disciplining that and finding other things and filling it basically with experiments from around the world. My biggest regret, by the way, because I only had 6 months at the Biennale, I couldn't travel to see these things, so it was very internet-based, weakness in itself. Mm-hmm. For the Arsenale, I sent out a question to about three or four dozen architects who I respected and thought were doing experimental work. And that was, how can we take those systems that control our daily lives and that are mainly of a technological nature, and how can we reveal them, mm-hmm. appropriate them, and domesticate them in such a manner that we can feel at home in the modern world? And I put that question out and asked for proposals, and out of the answers selected about two dozen projects, gave them each a little bit of money, and they all spent about 10 times as much, and made installations in the Arsenale. And that's more or less how I filled it.
And so many of them had a kind of installation and performative quality about them. Why did that happen? I mean, it's not unusual for the Biennale to do that, but in fact, the ones that Aaron and I thought were the most powerful, like Gary's and Dylan Scafidio's gondola project, we thought were had that kind of quality to them.
Yeah.
About experiencing it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think because what you want to do when you show architecture is to have an experience of architecture. Mm-hmm. Now, we could have a nice long debate. We'd have to have several more bottles of wine to talk about what architecture is then. But certainly, qualities of construction, of spatial manipulations and sequencing and composition are all issues that you want to explore. And exploring them in a static sense is more difficult than activating them mm-hmm. through installation or performance.
Right. The one we remembered so much, too, was Carl Kimmelblau's mind.
Brain,
yeah.
Yeah.
There's a good picture of you with your head in the brain. That was never been built before, but created for the Biennale. So what were you trying to get at by including that 1960s project?
Well, Carl Kimmelblau very much was part of this invention of experimental architecture. Mm-hmm. The very name, the Cooperative of the Blue of Heaven, was tied in 68 when the firm was formed to the Paris revolutions and to the whole notion that beneath the paving stones, the beach, mm-hmm. The imagination to power, the whole notion that we need not to build a perfectly designed world, but we need to liberate the unconscious, we need to liberate the body, we need to liberate social relations. And their experiments from that era were all about that kind of opening up a space within the city by burning things, by cutting holes, by attacking the static structures, both social and physical, around them. And some of their ideas were so wild they only existed as drawings.
Right.
And when I sent this call out, Wolf Prix got in touch with me and said, we had always dreamed of doing something like this, and now we think we have the technology to do it.
To build it.
So
yeah.
They did.
To work in Venice is to be so... it's hard not to be attentive to what's come before and to feel like one has to somehow respond to that history. In speaking about experience and the experiential approach that you sought to instantiate in the exhibit, were you kind of subtly referencing Portuguese? Were you trying to resist that model that the Strada Novissima represents?
My great models were the Strada Novissima, and if I had the money and the power, I would have made something more like the Strada Novissima.
So you don't see it as something that has past that represents a historical model. You see this one that has continued.
No, it's very much a historical moment in its facadism alone, in the notion that you can reduce architecture to a series of masks that present themselves in one dimension, and that you can allow architects to then just present their own little follies within that. Limited. But the spectacular quality, I never saw it in real life, but what you get from the photographs and when you talk to people who were there, the spectacular sense of a new city emerging in the darkness, out of the darkness of the Arsenale, was spectacular. My other big model was Aldo Rossi and his Theater of the World, floating in the lagoon of Venice. Those were the kind of things I really wanted to try to achieve. Mm-hmm. I did see the Biennale as reacting to its predecessors in the sense that Dejan Sujic tried to find architecture by reducing it to the nuggets of the best form. Kurt Forster tried to find the best ideas. And then Ricky Burdett tried to find the economic infrastructure and social infrastructure for that. And I felt like they had surveyed the field, and now it was time to kick out the jams to do something that showed what was possible beyond the kind of clarity and sometimes depressing truths that they had revealed.
On that note, Francesco Dalco had, of course, commissioned the Sterling Bookstore, and Kurt Forster had shared with us when we interviewed him his dreams of having redone the landscaping of the Giardini, which he wasn't able to do. Did you have some? I mean, you clearly commissioned various installations in the Giardini and elsewhere. Did you have some aspiration to do something of that sort, something that would leave a residue?
One of the first things I suggested was that we redo the Giardini, and they all laughed and said, every director says that.
And how so? How did you want to redo it?
As a project, as a set of projects. But instead, what we were able to do, I realized that however much I might demonstrate, there was still a kind of utopian quality to what I was doing, so I decided to do that head on. And I remember the end of Candide, Il faut cultiver notre jardin. So I said, well, we need a garden. That is a Garden of Eden, a new Garden of Eden. So I called Catherine Gustafson and took her out to the kind of leftover garden that's all the way at the end of the Arsenale, the Garden of the Virgins, beautifully named, and said, why don't we look at this? And there was all kinds of problems because the Chinese had dibs on it and all this kind of stuff. And she looked at this wall and said, well, what's behind that wall? And they said, well, it's a mess. And she said, can I see the mess? And she found this unclaimed piece of ruined garden. And that became her project, to renovate it into half a prototype for how we could turn our cities into places for urban gardening, and half into a really utopian, beautifully abstracted space surmounted by helium balloons representing all of us going to heaven. And Barata and the organization took one look at this and said, fantastic. We keep it. Not only do we keep it, but they built a bridge at the back of the garden, which reconnects the Arsenale right to the center of Castello, the neighborhood between the Arsenale and the Giardini, so that you now have a shortcut right into that part of town. And so that I'm very proud of, because I think that's something that we left behind for future Biennales to enjoy.
That's interesting. Yeah, one question, we sort of thought of it as the end, but maybe I'd like to bring it up now, because you've been talking about the problems of exhibition is Erin and I spoke to Kazuko Seijima about her ideas, and she, without going into them too much, is sort of reacting to the ubiquity of the internet and to architecture all around us, and trying, in a way, I think it's in a kind of theatrical way, to do what you're doing. How do you think that's changed the internet and exhibition, the display of architecture, changed exhibitions, and did it at all impact on how you thought about your exhibition?
Like earlier today, for instance, so give us another reference. Earlier today, you explained that you're actually kind of done with exhibitions. Was the Biennale in a certain sense like a last attempt?
Maybe. It was certainly probably the largest exhibition I'll probably ever get to do. So what do you do after that? I think there's two questions here. One is about exhibitions and one is about the Internet. The interesting thing about the Internet is that it takes away, on the one hand, the novelty that Biennale has had and that even biennials like the Whitney have. Traditionally, one of the reasons you would schlep from wherever you are to Venice or to the Whitney or to the Carnegie or to any of these kind of events is because it was your chance to see things from all over the world. And now, we were talking this morning, each of us, every morning as we have our coffee and in between phone calls, surf 40 or 50 sites. And everything that anyone from Chile to Timbuktu is doing is on the Internet within a day or two. It's very rare that you find something that manages to remain hidden from that power. So the Internet is like a continual biennale.
Right. Yeah.
Everything is continually on display. On the one hand, that makes it easier because it means that you have a better chance of finding interesting work from around the world that you otherwise might miss. I think that shouldn't be underestimated. Mm-hmm. And if you find someone interesting and you can then give them a chance to do something really great, that's a positive thing. I think that also puts pressure on you because it's not enough for someone just to show their stuff because you can see it on your screen. You have to let them do something that will make it be worth going there physically to see it. And so that sort of also answers the question about exhibitions. People complain about the need for exhibitions to be more and more spectacular. Yes. And what is wrong with that? I think that just as art itself is putting more and more emphasis on its own experiential qualities or is finding ways of integrating itself with community and media in a way that is completely disseminated. Mm-hmm. So the medium exhibition is also either exploding out into the street, from the Shepherd Fairies to all the other people exhibiting around town, Gormley here, right here, or it is becoming places where the most amazing objects and images and spaces are collected and are surrounded with a very elaborate framework that heightens your experience of them. And I think it is forcing exhibitions to try to understand what their essence is and what they're about. And I think there's nothing wrong with that.
Right. Well, just as Olympia said, Van Allen's not doing anything for a year. You're talking about giving up exhibitions. So.
At the Art Museum, I've come to the conclusion that it's a slightly different question. We tend to think of museums as machines for making exhibitions. Mm-hmm. But they're not. Art museums are machines for bringing people and art together. And in fact, I've changed our mission statement, so that's what it says. The Cincinnati Art Museum brings the people of the greater Cincinnati, Northern Kentucky area and great art together. Period. End of it. No ifs, buts, or any other asides to it. When you then have to ask the question, what is the best way to do that? And it turns out that doing standard exhibitions is a very expensive way. It's almost impossible to do a decent art exhibition for less than a few hundred thousand dollars these days. It's a very expensive way to do that. So you have to use exhibitions in a very strategic manner. And you have to focus them on really spectacular things. And given the limits that the Cincinnati Art Museum has, I think
financial limits,
space limits, every other limit, I think it's much better for us to concentrate on developing new ways of unlocking what is our great strength, which is one of the greatest collections in America with 60,000 pieces of great art, and framing them in continually new ways so that they truly can be, those experiences can be mined by the visitors.
I want to go back to your exhibit in Venice, and in particular one of the perhaps least spectacular installations, which for me was the most memorable of those that you had commissioned, and it was Diller and Scofidio's two-screen projection, in which the viewer is kind of vicariously placed in the role of the tourist who takes a gondola ride. And as the projection continues, and as you listen to their narration, it kind of seamlessly cuts between three Venices, at least I counted three. The Venice of Macau, the Venice of Las Vegas, and the Venice of the Veneto region, where one is as one's watching it. And it seemed that that offered what some of the other installations didn't in your show, which is that here an artist was commenting on the very city in which they were exhibiting. And there was a certain relationship being articulated between the Biennale and the city of Venice, and the future of Venice, in a way. And I was interested, is that how you had seen that piece? Were you really interested in it for other reasons?
Well, I mean, I when I first talked to Diller and Scofidio and Renfro, one of their first comments was that they want to think about and look at Venice in particular. And, of course, Venice is itself one giant piece of display. It's a display machine more than anything else. The question of how you display that, I think, is an interesting one. I don't think that either they or anyone else that I know of has really managed to do that in a truly effective manner. I'm still waiting for someone to really bring out that kind of profoundly and fundamentally textural quality in a critical manner. But what they did was instead look at aspects of Venice and how they were confronting technology. Their original idea was to look at the technology that allows us to live in Venice, either as tourists or as real people, plumbing, air conditioning, all the modern technology that is hidden behind those facades. And they were going to have a pipe running into the canal next to the Arsenale, bringing water through a series of beautifully designed refinery equipment, and out would come a perfect cup of coffee. Again, a kind of touristic notion of what Italy is, which you would be able to drink. The authorities would not let them do this, and we can talk later about why they wouldn't let them do this. So instead, they did the gondola, which talked about the touristic, or showed the touristic aspect of the city. And by the way, it was supposed to be five places, but they were not allowed to film in, is it Dubai or... Yeah, Dubai has one,
yes,
but they weren't allowed to film there because women would be in the shots. And the other place, they weren't allowed to film somewhere else where they, for legal reasons, so they were somewhat restricted. I thought it was quite beautiful. I wish it was more complete. I wish that they had created more of an illusion around it. If you glance to either side of the screen, you... found yourself sitting in the middle of the Arsenale again, which I thought was a bit of a shame.
Would it be reductive to say that at its best, the Biennale enables artists and architects to reflect on the conditions of the site? I mean,
it depends on what you mean by the site.
The city of Venice, for instance, and the complicated future that it faces as it's caught in the
I think it's the site of architecture, the site of the Arsenale or the Italian Pavilion, the site of Venice, the site of all those centers of display which we used to think of as our center cities around the world. I think that the best architecture has to confront the notion that the solidity we once looked for in buildings and cities is sprawling out of control, and we have to find ways of reacting to that in a critical manner.
Which other of the we've talked about Gehry and Paul Pimmelblau and Diller and Scofidio, Renfro. Which other ones did really stand out in your mind from in the Arsenale building? Oh,
gosh, I mean there was quite a few beautiful ones.
I think I'm the only one who really liked Nigel Coates' installation, right. which people were somewhat critical about, because I thought it was a very beautiful way of looking at architecture as as something that occurs not as the making of objects, but as a relationship between bodies, mm-hmm. and between bodies and buildings, and between buildings and cities, and trying to find a sensuality rather than a kind of harsh criticality, a kind of sensual criticality, mm-hmm. In those relationships, and demonstrating that right. with, for those of you that weren't there, it started from a series of saddle forms and moved from there to dancers dancing over and around each other's bodies in a screen that surrounded you in 360 degrees, and then moved to a urban scale with these miniature versions of the same saddles as if they were a cityscape with planes going overhead. I thought it was a very effective way of doing that. But
now, when we saw that, the video wasn't on. It makes it very different. This is another
technology.
Problem of Venice.
Yeah.
You also had the films at the beginning, too. What was
yes,
the one of that?
The
Casey Jones did, I think?
It was Reed Korloff and Casey Jones together with David Rockwell.
Mm-hmm.
When I started, about a month after I was finally given the commission, which was not till February, we met in New York with some of the people in the Biennale at Dello Scafidio Renfro's office with a couple of people in attendance. Karen Stein was there. A couple of Marcin Zeslina, a Polish guy who was also a curator. And we all sort of thought about, and Reed and Casey, sort of people I knew who I thought could help me think about this. And in talking about it, we realized that we all have in our heads a very powerful architecture already that is beyond buildings, and that is the architecture that we grew up with in movies and in television. Mm-hmm. The architecture of The Wizard of Oz, of Blade Runner, of Matrix, of, for me, the great Antonioni movies, Blow Up, and things like that. And they're what sticks in our mind when we imagine a city as much as the real buildings. Bernard Tschumi said it said more or less the same thing about 30 years ago.
Manhattan Transfer.
Yeah, exactly. And so we decided that we would show that by creating what we call a hall of mirrors, where you would see yourself refracted in these memories. Of course, it was also an homage to Aldo Rossi and what he did with his Biennale. And Casey and Reed said, well, that's all fine and well, but we can't do that. So they got in touch with David Rockwell, the master of illusion. And he came up with these spectacular new computer technologies that allowed these fragments of images to come floating by you, and so you were bathed in these memories.
And it was the first thing you saw when you had
yeah, and that was your indoctrination that you were going into another world.
Right.
I have two different questions. The first kind of calls our attention back to Kurt Forster's 9th Venice Architecture Biennale. I'm going to read some of the comments that he made to us. He remarked that it required divine guidance. The Italian government cut the show's budget, which was already spaghetti thin, forcing him to become, quote, a beggar on every corner in Europe. He had to postpone the opening when the Venice Film Festival had coincided. And in every sense, he found himself caught up in a kind of a, what seemed to be a logistical nightmare. And did you have a different experience?
Very different. Again, he had the worst of it because he had a very bad president, a very bad executive director. I had President Baratta and Andrea Del Mercato, who was a fantastic executive director, and Manuela Lucadazio, who is now the head of the architecture section. But more than that, I think it's very easy to blame, and this is not meant as a criticism of Kurt, because I know he had a very difficult time. Robert Storr had the same administration, and he's even more vicious about it than... and very publicly vicious about it than Kurt Forster is. But, of course, there was not enough money to do things, and, of course, there's bureaucracy. But, you know, when I gave up trying to be an architect many years ago and decided to organize stuff, you learn that organizing stuff means that you confront these kind of difficulties. And I actually found the difficulties, given the scale of the operation, not nearly as large as I had feared. You have to, it was easier for me than for the architects. I had to explain to the architects who would run in optimistically and say, oh, we'll do this. And I said, okay, now remember little things like the fact that it costs as much to ship a container full of material from Shanghai to Mestre, the port of Venice, as it then costs to get the material from Mestre into the Biennale. It's, you know, it's a very complicated situation. Not my problem, their problem. So once you understand those parameters, I don't think it was nearly as difficult as I thought. The other important, the two things to understand. First of all, Italy as a country is interested in and supports architecture. And once you work with the press and they get excited for or against, it means that things have to happen. And the press in Italy is a wonderful weapon to get things done. And I had a lot of fun working with that. The second is that Venice is an incredible draw. I mean, people will do almost anything to be in Venice and show their work in Venice and be part of the Venice Biennale because they know that 200,000 people will see it and it will be in all the newspapers. And so the ability to leverage those qualities is one of the things that I think makes a Biennale very doable. The budget is not nearly enough, but it is more than any other situation I've ever worked in. So,
Gregotti and Francesco Dalco in particular kind of cautioned us. They said that you can't just understand the history of the Biennale by understanding the curatorial manifestations, that you have to understand the political climate of the Board of Overseers and things of that. Is that... did that not impact you in the way that maybe in an earlier historical moment it impacted them?
I met the Board of Overseers twice, and that was it. And they were, you know, I met Cacciari, the mayor, who was a great philosopher, which was a real honor for me. But as I said, Paolo Barata was extremely helpful. The trick again was the press.
I didn't understand and that. Could you explain how does that make things happen? That's so. No one's told us that yet in all of our
If you say things in a way that are provocative, without being obnoxious, and you manage to get one or two of the key critics to agree with you, it creates a lot of public interest and a lot of debate back and forth, and then. From my perspective, and what I understand talking to people, is the Board of Overseers are happy if they get the sense that it is seen as being something alive. Mm-hmm. And having something that people are angry about, right, or are worried about is as good as people being excited. The last thing you want is for it to be boring.
Right.
And to be completely non-committal. So when I, you know, Gregotti, and I didn't even have to do anything. Before, when my name was announced, Gregotti wrote editorial for Corriere della Sera, I think, denouncing my appointment and saying how terrible it was going to be. And I said, I haven't even said what I'm going to do. So I decided that two could play that game. So at my first press conference, they asked me what I thought of it, and I said, "No, he can say what he wants. You know, as far as I'm concerned, he's an irrelevant architect, and I've learned more about Italian architecture from Bertolucci or Antonioni than I ever did from Gugotti." And that got a lot of press.
That got a lot of press.
And then a good debate started, and a few very interesting critics came to see me and had very serious questions.
Italian
critics, yeah. Oh, the foreign critics. All that. This is the interesting thing about my Biennale. The Italian press, on the whole, in the end, loved it. Mm-hmm. The foreign press hated it. I think it's a record. I was panned on the same day in the most important papers of
El País in Spain, the Frankfurt Allgemeine in Germany, Le Monde in France, The Guardian in England, and the LA Times, with the New York Times adding its own insult by refusing to even review
it. Yeah,
all in the same day. So, I mean, it was devastating, but I sort of knew that was going to happen.
And why did the Italians like it? Because you think because you engaged with it?
Yeah, and because it brought up, it said that architecture is not just making buildings, it is a social activity, and it is a question of understanding where we are and who we are through where we are. Mm-hmm. And by attacking also the... there's a kind of Sorotic, historic preservation-based...
Right.
Mafia that controls most major construction in Italy, architecture construction, and by attacking them head on, it created debate and interest. And
I want to go back to the story of the shipping container that costs as much to get from Shanghai to Mestre as it does from Mestre to Giardini. From where I sit, from kind of when I look at art and architecture today on display, I'm particularly interested in sharing with the public those stories, because they impact so much of what you see.
Mm.
Do you feel interested in... Is that conceit that logistics could be shared with the public? The story of how things come to be should be something that's also displayed. Is that of interest to you? Is that precisely what a show is not?
I'm not very interested in process. I am interested... I think logistics as a kind of... as a reality of modernity. I mean, modernity is, as Richard Sennett said years ago, Marshall Berman, it is, in the end, no more than the continual movement of people, goods, and information. That's what modernity is. That's our reality. And finding ways of displaying that. In fact, I really want to do a second Biennale. I was going to call it Shrink Wrap. And it was going to be about the reduction of all reality to the most condensed things and having them in wrappers, and then the containerization of things. And I was finally going to build this project I was once going to do with MVRDV, which was a huge pavilion made out of shipping containers enclosing. You can stack them up 8 high and you can create a huge space out of it, but some other time. If anyone has a couple of $1 million, I have the plans ready, I'll do it. That interests me. And the other thing that interests me is the notion of construction, of the making of things. And Frank Gehry's pavilion I also thought was very, very beautiful, because he went back to something he said years ago, which is a building under construction is much more beautiful than when it's finished, and showed a building as scaffolding, which again is something Colin Rowe talked about. For me, the essence of collage city is not the collage, but when he talks about scaffolding, that I would have loved to have done more with. And if they give me another Biennale, I'll do more with.
I want to go back to the Netherlands Architecture Institute and your long-time, 25-year engagement in research and education. Did you see that as something that should play out in your Biennale? Was the Everyville competition your idea? Was it Baratta's? Could you talk about the degree to which you saw the Biennale as an educational opportunity that either should engage students or should be addressed to students?
It's one of the failures of the Biennale, and I think it's not just my failure, because I think Ricky Burdett was the only one who started to really get students involved, because he really built his Biennale out of universities. In the end, I think even there, the faculty took over more than the students, but still...
So all the research was done by universities?
Yes, yes. And it was organized around a series of nodes, universities around the world that did research and did projects, and they all came together to make the heart of the Biennale. We had very short time, so we couldn't set out these kind of projects. And there should be an educational component, and very early on they said, what is it going to be? We came up with this competition. It was... It didn't work very well. We didn't get it out enough. We didn't get enough people to know about it. There was going to be another component, which Domus was going to take care of, which we were very happy about, which was going to involve students working in workshops. That really never happened. So the answer is that's, for me, was one of the failures of the Biennale. And however, I'm not sure how you can do that better, except
Bharata's dream, which I think is a fantastic one, is to make the Biennale, the La Biennale di Venezia, which is the overarching organization of which he is president, into a permanent institute that produces periodically the Art Biennale, the Architecture Biennale, the Film Festival, the Dance Festival, and the Theater Festival, and controls the archives. And based on that, this is my interpretation, creates a kind of research and development institute that is a permanent center for the study of the history and future of the built environment. I sort of dream of it as a kind of architectural equivalent of the of Princeton's Institute for Advanced Studies. And if he ever pulls it off, I think that would
be
a great way
to pull that off. It's incredible. Ambitious.
All the pieces are there.
Yeah.
And the resources are starting to be there. He might be able to. It depends. There, I think it does depend on politics, which does not look so good right now.
Right.
But that, I think that would be absolutely spectacular. But I think that a biennale or an exhibition is not the best place to show student work in general. I think that there is a skill to presenting, which is what you do in a show like that, that is learned. And though students can be wonderfully exuberant and sometimes do great stuff, it also takes a certain amount of experience and discipline to build up the ability to show things in a spectacular way.
And you would say the same about curating, I suppose? I mean,
yes.
You know, this notion that Bill alluded to earlier, that today we find ourselves in a moment when curating is becoming professionalized and institutionalized in a way that perhaps it hasn't happened before. You can get a degree in curating.
Yeah.
So I guess, would there be something similar here as well?
I'm waiting to see the real results of curating programs. So I don't really know what they're going to produce. It is a very weird thing because traditionally there's been no way to learn how to be a curator, and there really has been no way to learn how to be a curator in the fields of architecture and design. And there's a steep learning curve in that, and finding ways which Cooper Hewitt is trying to do and some other places are trying to do to make that more open and a clearer path, I think is fantastic. On the other hand, the opportunities are very few. On the other hand, the notion of curating is changing even as we speak and is opening up to different kinds of people, and people now talk about, there was just an article in the New York Times few days ago about curating dance performances. It's becoming a much more malleable word. So I'm not sure if the programs will be able to keep up with the mutations in the field.
Shall we open this up to the audience? Or,
I have one last question. It has to do with the question of the archive. And what's so fascinating about that Venice Biennale, the Biennale di Venezia, is that it has the most remarkable archives, and they're also perhaps the most difficult to access.
Nobody knows what's in it.
And I was wondering if you had spent any time in the archives. When we spoke to Bharata, he had explained that your Biennale had been a particularly difficult one for them from the archival perspective, because your Biennale had played out on a BlackBerry so much. And there was this question of does all correspondence carry the same archival weight? How do you archive a BlackBerry?
That's a
huge... And it wasn't even their BlackBerry. Yeah. It was not even their property. It was yours.
Yeah. That's a big... And in fact, I could not have done that Biennale without... I could have had to quit my day job because I did the Biennale visiting Venice 8 times and running an art museum, a full-time, fairly substantial art museum at the same time. So without modern technology, I couldn't have done it. Yes, how you archive modern material is becoming very difficult. And, of course, in the world of architecture, more and more of what we produce is digital. And so what is it that you preserve? And let's not forget, I was the first person, as far as I know, to make websites part of a permanent collection of an art museum when I was in San Francisco. And they still curse me to this day, as they curse David Ross, who had them collect digital projects at the Whitney, because they finally did the sums for me. And I kept saying to them, well, you know, these websites are free. And they pointed out to me that in order to maintain a website in an archival manner, meaning that you should be able to experience them 200 years from now in the manner in which they were designed, cost in 1999 $20,000 a year per website, because you have to keep it running continually with backups. You have the original equipment. You have to have then second set of equipment that's updated. You have to have redundant copies operating in server farms underneath the Alps. And then if you really want to be archival, you have to print every zero and one of the code out into telephone books and keep those in a bomb-proof shelter in the Alps as well. So it's a huge job. So it's a very... it's a very big issue.
How did you document your Biennale? Clearly, you had
Didn't.
But I mean, clearly the publication that you oversaw was one attempt at that.
Yeah.
And Sejima told us that she's planning maybe something very small and simple and compact. I mean, the publication would be one archival maneuver that you made.
Yeah, and I very consciously worked with Tonic, who I think are the great unsung heroes of the Biennale, because they helped me really create
the
coherence.
Well,
the designs of the catalog and of the overall Biennale.
Oh, okay.
They did the balls, they did everything.
Mm-hmm.
And we came up with the idea of not making a catalog, because you need different things. You need something that's like a Baedeker, that you, a Vademecum, that you carry with you. You need something that's more coffee table-like. I also felt, since I am rather strident in my beliefs, that you needed manifestos, and I commissioned manifestos, and we collected those in a book. In the end, you had five different publications that together make up a kind of sprawling Biennale documentation. Beyond that, I mean, one of the things I have found is that my photographs of the Biennale are awful. And I keep asking the Biennale to send me better photographs, and theirs are worse than mine. So if anyone has good photographs of the Biennale, I would love them, because they were very difficult to photograph.
And the photographs would be the way that you would want your Biennale in history to be perceived and understood.
Right, and little QuickTime movies, and which of course then you put them in a PowerPoint and they crash. But to be able to show them, absolutely.
But the history of your Biennale wouldn't necessarily be best understood through the correspondence. It would be understood through those installation shots and documentation.
Yeah, because correspondence was definitely BlackBerry or email messages.
MoMA tried to have that ongoing discussion during the Biennale.
Right.
They've done that before.
Right.
Does that stay alive? Does that keep? Is that still alive, or does that
die?
Not
sure. They in the end, they didn't have money, so they...
They did it with the Architecture Foundation in London.
Right. And I was really happy about that, and we gave them a really nice room in the center of it, and then about 3 weeks before the Biennale, they said, no, we don't have the money.
Right.
So that was really a shame.
Yeah. The story of Venice. Questions, Robert?
Robert.
Yeah. He may have the $2 million for your show.
Yeah, no, even the Dutch don't have it anymore.
Now, you know, listening to you and also having visited Venice myself multiple times, you know, this whole notion of the city as a platform, you know, the idea of spectacle, the notion of display versus perhaps production instead of curating. And it's like these questions arise in me, which leads me to one very big question is, do you think it's still valid to separate architecture and design and visual arts and performance arts and film biennials, apart from this whole idea of creating an institute that is an ongoing... I mean, it's basically you're institutionalizing Venice.
Yeah. Good question. Ideally, no. Practically, I think it would be very difficult to pull off. But it's funny, because I was accused of doing an art biennale, and the curator of the art biennale was accused of doing an architecture biennale. And there's some truth to that. I do think that the borders are disappearing. The one thing that I think we should not forget is that I do think that architecture as a discipline has particular qualities, particular elements, particular knowledge to contribute. And that should not be forgotten in the same way that painting does or that furniture does. But ideally, I think absolutely, I think that there should be an annual or biannual event where all the ways in which we as a culture try to make sense of our modern world and change it through representation and through rebuilding and through our bodies and every other way we can think of are collected. So,
well, it's something that I am now personally experiencing with a lot of architects and designers and artists that are trekking all the way to Detroit right now.
Yeah.
You know, what's happening there, it's the same kind of notion of the city or the region as a platform that poses a lot of questions and that provides in many different ways a platform.
Yeah.
And I found that very interesting in your approach to the biennial and also in your previous positions. So I was curious about your answer.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we just last night, as I'm sure many of you do, watched the first episode of the Treme, the new HBO series, and it's wonderful to see music used as a real manner and performance as a way of singing the city back alive or playing the city back alive and understanding the way in which all these different cultural means can do that, I think is of vital importance. And Rocco Landisman has made much the same argument in his artworks slogan for the NEA. So I absolutely think we should be doing that. And I think that the strength of Venice is that it is Venice, and that you can use the power of those traditions and its attraction to make that argument in a very forceful manner.
In fact, there are always, Aaron Levy's collected some great images of architecture before the Architecture Biennale. There always was architecture in the art biennales, and the Architecture Biennale grew out of a 1968 student protest of the Art Biennale. It's a longer story, but that was sort of why they decided to do architecture, because architecture was something real, and the students were claiming that the Art Biennale, somehow art wasn't real, and this was the response to come back. So this Molino Stuckey competition in 75 was a response by the directors of the Biennale to, I think they still thought of it as an Art Biennale, but do something in Venice.
It was interesting because one of the things that when I first arrived in Venice, I said, you know, I actually did a project for Biennale once. And they looked at me and said, really? He said, yeah, you had a competition for the Piazzale di Roma,
right,
for redoing it. And an architect from L.A. called Michele Sai and I entered that together and did this fabulous model of the whole Piazzale, mm-hmm, and the bus station and becoming one unfolding landscape. And they said, really? And they went and they hunted through the archive and they found, you said they couldn't find it, they found it within an hour or so and trotted it back out.
What year was that?
That would have been 19... Let me think, it was in L.A., so it would have been sort of 88, right around there. So.
Bill and I, of course, we had a very different experience with Venice because we felt like we were constantly fighting it. And maybe that was the nature of
if you do a pavilion, the country pavilions, it's much more so, because the country pavilions exist as these objects within a giardini, which is also a kind of bureaucratic structure. And there's unions and there's regulations. The Dutch, luckily, have a good team that knows how to work that. Next time you do one, let me know, and I'll lend you one or two of those people there. Right?
Olympia, you want to ask?
Yeah, I guess, architecture and display, and then the two words that are, you were tangent around them, that is audience and context. And what I was thinking, you know, if we are talking about architectural display, the Venice Biennale is a very specific context. And for once, and I hope it's the only time in my life, I find myself to agree with Dalco and Gregotti in the sense that politics in that particular city are so important about these biennales, because basically, if the biennales were not there, they had no money. That's all there.
That's not true. That's not true at all. What's very interesting, sorry to disagree with you. Because you and I have the impression that when we go to the Art or Architecture Biennale, the only people there are every artist or architect we ever have known in our lives. They're all there at the same time. When the Architecture Biennale is on, less than 4% of the visitors are connected to the Architecture Biennale. When the Art Biennale is around, you know, you really think that there's nothing, you can't get a hotel room, you know, it's nothing, but the art world is there. 8% of the visitors in Venice at that time are connected to the Biennale. Yes, there's a multiplier. They invest a total of about 3 million euros in a Biennale, depending on the year, somewhere between 2 and 4. And the multiplier is probably about 12 to 15. So, yes, it is an important thing. But it is smaller, for instance, than the big cruise ships.
But let's tell you, I mean, you know definitely better the numbers than me. But what my impression has been is that between the three biennales and et cetera, is also the way that you create jobs in a different way for the Venetians. So that's what I include there. But anyway, let's go back to the bigger idea that was display, context, and audience. For example, when you and I visit the Biennale, especially the first 3 days, that is not open to the public.
Yeah.
And that's basically when most of the people who have an architectural degree visit it, except for the students and some Italians. So what I was thinking was that we should also, though banal, and I really believe that we need to think what we're going to be doing, there is an issue about exhibiting architecture for the general public that is very different than what we are discussing.
Absolutely. Well, it goes back to my point that I think it's almost impossible to make a successful architecture exhibition. You have to go to extreme measures like build 5 buildings in an empty lot next to the museum, like MoMA did. There are very, very few architecture exhibits that have any kind of public draw. Design exhibits, you have a little bit more luck. But it's a niche business, and again, I think you have to think about extending the boundaries and the definitions of what an architecture exhibition is to really make it work. What's interesting, for instance, is that one of the most effective architecture exhibitions in New York is the Guggenheim Museum, and when they did a survey a number of years ago, the number one reason by a factor of 4 or 5 that people come to the Guggenheim is to see the building. Not necessarily because they like Frank Lloyd Wright or anything like that. They just know it as a sight, a spectacle to go see. And even when they have blockbusters, the visitorship varies very little because the constant visitorship is really about the building. So creating spaces that are, if architecture is going to display itself, it has to do so in an iconic and effective manner. And that probably is more effective than hanging drawings on the wall. Except if you want all your friends to see them and have a discussion. And that's another issue.
Very interesting sense that an exhibition isn't successful because of its immediate success. I mean, in the end, it's sort of when it's, I don't know, like architects, there's visionary architecture in MoBA in 1960, it might have not caused that immediate sort of attention of a general public, but it certainly addressed the profession at large, which eventually sort of shifted some sort of perception of architecture. And I don't know, in that sense, I also disagree that architecture exhibition should be something spectacular, but that because that might only address something immediate, but it would never sort of address the professions.
Well, I think
which would eventually, in the long term, shift or change something.
Yeah, I think that it absolutely is important for the discipline of architecture to find ways of bringing out essential issues of architecture in a way that they can be collectively viewed and understood. And since architects are not very good at making movies, making exhibitions is a pretty good way to do it. My counter model to you would be something like the Beaux-Arts show that Arthur Drexler did at MoMA in 1978, somewhere right around there. Do you remember, Jane? Someone here must remember. That changed the world of architecture. I mean, it made us aware of a completely of something that wasn't a secret, that was there for everyone to understand, but getting those huge, gorgeous drawings out and seeing them and discovering the joys of poche planning and of ink wash drawing was like a huge explosion in the world of architecture. But it was because those images were so effective. And I think that
We are 116-year-old Panarin. We used to be the Beaux-Arts Institute of New York. So without knowing, you are creating a conflict here.
And then as a counter argument, I would say to you that the second most, there are two other effective moments in MoMA's design department. One was the famous Italian New Domestic Landscape, which was effective because it was objects of everyday life. And the third was Complexity and Contradiction, which they published, and maybe Reichert's book, which they also published, which wasn't an exhibition, but which also radically transformed architecture.
But the Beaux-Arts show is more about showing spectacular drawings. It was introducing sort of like that postmodernist philosophy through this in all of their drawings.
Oh, it was much more than that.
Yeah.
I mean, the catalog, and this is, again, how things operate, the catalog is the monument, is what remains of any exhibition, if it's a good catalog. That catalog, they called the Beaux-Arts, its essays, I still quote them, use them continually, and they really went to the heart of what was interesting, important, and difficult and evil about the teachings of the École des Beaux-Arts. The show, yes, might have led to all kinds of postmodern pastiches, but that catalog really rescued a very important set of historical issues for architecture.
Yeah, in that case, I also think that what remains is learning from Las Vegas, not the catalog. I mean, it sort of like started this other trend of controversial thinking and not the catalog.
Not sure what you mean, but remember that, you know, we in architecture think about learning from Las Vegas and, oh my God, everything changed, a new way of looking. We have a show up right now at the Cincinnati Art Museum called Starburst, which is about color photography in the 1970s, which is when color photography burst on the scene and transformed the whole world of photography and a certain set of art, mainly by looking at everyday life. And they didn't need theoreticians like Venturi to do that. They just needed good photographers, good artists, to look at everyday life. They needed movies like Five Easy Pieces to open our eyes to the America that we otherwise had never noticed. So we think we have to understand it as part of a bigger cultural phenomenon as well. Just as I think that, though I don't know it yet now, I hope, if I'm lucky, that I'll look back on the Biennale 10, 20 years from now and say, oh yes, it was part of a set of ideas that also was evidenced there and there and there and there, and that changed things in a particular way. It doesn't happen in isolation.
Any
okay.
Last questions?
There's one more question, and then we'll wrap this up and have some wine.
Yeah. It's funny that you projects, not being good at making movies, when the there was a video piece which you guys all liked, and wish would have to work on that, was basically a movie. I did the shop drawings on it, but there was just this like a piece of metal that hanged a projector from this.
Yeah.
Viewing a stuff, you know, like it was special way, but then we had to go write this script and like, and that was like writing a script, you know, and then we had to go shoot the thing and edit it. So it was just making a movie. Yeah. And but it's when you talk about like exhibitions, which are models and drawings, obviously these are often redone or they're pictures of like, built work and stuff, but they're the same forms as the nerdy drawings that we make as a means of making architecture or buildings in a certain way. There's a set of practices which are traditionally ours, where you think of something, you draw, you sketch it, you craft it, you put it out to bid, you know, and then and so the show models and drawings are is to show like the means of making a certain kind of architecture.
Yeah.
And then when we talk about going beyond building these mm-hmm. These techniques are not alien anymore. Particularly like my, I found a lot of effect of technology on you know, design is not you know, what it makes possible, but it makes a lot of these things that used to be very difficult for years practice is very easy and opens up a whole other realm of working. And so when there's this like when there's this notion of the right tool and then if people who invested in tools when the job teach changing
mm-hmm.
Is it that we did and then people live in these weird positions of looking for jobs and using tools they have rather than looking for the tools to get done.
Yeah.
Could it be that maybe there's other things to show now?
That there are other things to show now?
Other things to show.
Like if architecture is
beyond building.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I think that first of all, you know, it's interesting that some of the most interesting directors, movie directors, studied as architects.
Right.
And one of the things that I've been arguing in education for a long time, which is one of the reasons why every time I've gone for deanship I haven't gotten it, is that I make the argument that architecture schools should not be places that teach people professional tools so that they can learn how to make buildings. I think it's kind of you learn that out there in the real world. And if you're going to be a draft monkey, you might as well do it in China or India, where most things will be drafted. Next year anyhow. Architecture schools should be places where you learn how to see your physical environment in a particular way and do something about it. And that means you can do something about it in any number of different media and forms. Some architects become politicians, movie makers, painters, companies. There's a great article waiting to be written about the architects who were at the core of a lot of the organizational reformations in American business in the 60s mm-hmm. and 70s. A lot of the original McKinsey guys, and even before McKinsey, a lot of those people were architects who brought the particular ways of thinking of architecture into organizational think. And Reinhold Martin has alluded mm-hmm. to some of those things. There's a lot of other things you can do. And maybe it's better to make movies or to do things, but you're right like that. But you're right, you need specific tools. The problem is those tools are expensive and complicated. And when you look at the firms that have gone furthest at acquiring those tools and getting good at it, the most stellar example would be David Rockwell's firm. And even they can't afford the really great stuff. But in order to achieve some of their effects, they have to do the Oscars, and they have to do, you know, sort of overblown restaurants in Las Vegas. And after a while, you wonder, well, where where we're really pushing things, where we're getting things, and they have great people like Tucker Riemeister coming up with really great things. And at some point, I think it really will help reimagine our designed environment through tools borrowed from Hollywood and other places. But it's a long struggle, and I think Dillis Cofidio is on the critical edge of that. And I wish there were more firms like that willing to learn those tools and use those tools and really push them beyond what we have today.
Okay, great.
Perhaps I'll just end with one quick last question then.
Everybody wants wine, Aaron. Make it short.
The U.S. Pavilion, it exists perhaps more than any other national pavilion at a peculiar juncture between cultural production and cultural diplomacy. And I don't want you to say ours, but can you single out a particular past U.S. representation that has been a continual source of reflection for you? In my case, it was, for instance, Bill and I have spent a great deal of time talking about this, the Disney show that looked at the complexity of the avant-garde today, but it was also a representation which Krenz had kind of undertaken in the absence of an official selection that year. And is there a particular U.S. pavilion that offers a model that might be worth reclaiming, just as you spoke of Portuguese, let's say, as a model that you still think through?
Ooh. I mean, yours was pretty good, and I don't mean that just because you're here. It was pretty good. And it got at a lot of the issues I was trying to get at, which is not true with all the... For those of you that don't know, you have the Arsenale, you have the Italian Pavilion, then there are all these country pavilions, and the country pavilions are asked to respond to what the curator is proposing, and most of the time they don't. But they think they do, which is even more ironic. I mean, I was a country commissioner in three pavilions, and each time I thought I was coming up with a perfect answer to what the curator was doing, and each time the curator walked into the pavilion and said, "What the hell are you doing here?" So I think what's remarkable is how unremarkable the American pavilions have been. And it's this country has not obviously concentrated on them with the same kind of force that other countries have. And I think it could benefit from more sincere reflection and investment than it has in the past. You guys did a heroic job with very little money in the last minute, but to do something really spectacular, you're going to have to do, as a country, this country is going to have to invest a little bit more attention and effort to make it work, because the short answer is no.